Unfortunately, the speaker forgot to turn the mic on for about the first 20-some minutes of this tape, and so this will be a redub just to give a little bit of an idea of what was missing. In the first talk in this series, the speaker spoke about myths as being direct and literal. Literally, the language of the spiritual worlds. The last remnants of a mystery wisdom, an initiation into which made one capable of living and using the powers in the spiritual worlds. At that time, we talked about the uses of mysticism, as for the myths, are very much different than those that psychologists or anthropologists or historians or other people who utilize myths in other ways use them. The mystic uses them as a way to regain the understanding of the spiritual worlds and live that over again and unfold those qualities in self. That is not to say that any of the other uses of mythology are improper, since it is a universal language. It should speak to many people in many ways. It's just that we are using it as mystics use it. In this regard, the mystic thinks very much differently of symbols than the psychologist. For the psychologist, the symbol is a royal road to the psyche, to understand what goes on in the soul. That's not the case for the mystic. The mystics have always had an age-old saying that describes their sentiments exactly. And that saying is that a symbol conceals as much as it reveals. Therefore, while a symbol might reveal something about the spiritual worlds to the material, in its being a conduit, it is limited to that one area, or to the one pipeline, rather than being full-blown life itself. This talk, the intention is to correct what was said in the last talk. And that is to say that myths, since we are in the material world, are indeed symbolical, and for that reason present some problems to one who would try to talk about them literally. The material world is a focus of the inner spiritual worlds. And what transpires in focusing the spiritual worlds into the material worlds is very similar to what occurs in focusing a slide onto a screen. When passing through the lens, there is a simple inversion, so that some things are seen backwards. Since myths are brought into the material world, they have that same property. And sometimes, and it's difficult to tell without intuition or without some skill, to determine when something is to be taken as directly literal and when it is to be taken in exactly the opposite way. In general, the deepest spiritual material is brought about or brought to the material world in tragic form, because the deepest spiritual qualities must perforce, because of their distance from the focal lens, be the most likely to be inverted. Hence it is that tragedy is often much more soul-satisfying and much more difficult to understand than comedy, which tends to be more simple-minded and not always very satisfying. The talk at this point goes on to say how the speaker was seeking some sort of a sign as to how to go about presenting this material to make a complete 180-degree correction from the previous talk when one of his professors told him to go to hell. And that's exactly what he did. And the talk begins by talking about Hades. Not only Hades, but the whole underworld ruled by Hades and all of the denizens there. We spoke very briefly of the five rivers, Aornis, Acheron, Cocytus, Lethe, Pyroflegethon, and the swamp or circular river which they poured into, the Styx. The Aornis meaning birdless, Acheron meaning doom, Cocytus meaning river of lamentation or tears, Lethe being the river of forgetfulness, Pyroflegethon being the river of fire, and Styx being the lake or swamp or river of death and hatred. We mentioned the various different tortures that were apparently going on in Tartarus. The great giant Tityus, pinned to a rock with a eagle gnawing on his liver, very much like Prometheus, for his attempted rape of Artemis. Also, there was a mention of the torture of the Danaids for stabbing their 50 husbands, or 49 of the 50 stabbed their husbands with hairpins, and how they were forced to fetch water in sieves. Also was mentioned Oknus, who plaits a straw rope, which his ass eats as fast as he plaits it. And Peirithous, who is the sitting on the couch of forgetfulness, for demanding to be with Persephone, the queen of Tartarus. Clearly, this realm is in the desire world, because so many of the punishments have to do with desires that cannot be satisfied, which describes just about all desire when it becomes an end unto itself. We didn't talk much about these myths. That is being saved for perhaps another year when one studies, how would you say it? Cosmography or mythography or something like that, where the spiritual worlds or the mythical worlds are described and pointed out. The talk does go on to speak of Sisyphus. Sisyphus, the beloved and very dear friend and student of Zeus, who was himself initiated into the mysteries. And it talks about Sisyphus' punishment of rolling a stone up a hill, not being what it seems to be, but actually just the opposite. Because Sisyphus, the stone, represents the sun, and the raising it to a high declination only to have it sink back down again, to be controlling the rolling of the stone up either the declinational hill, as in the solar year, or at midsummer it is at the top of the hill, and at midwinter it is at the bottom, or whether it is a daily cycle where noon would be the top of the hill and it goes back down. In either case, the control of the sun literally means the control of the earth. And controlling the earth is to be our divine destiny in the future, when we take over and guide it like a spaceship, only not with instruments, but more with our thought, where we consciously focus on the divine plan, and in our interest and in our love, draw the world and all of its inhabitants with it on its course through our focused concentration. And it is at that juncture where the tape connects back in. I'm sorry for this break and interruption, but I don't think there have been any tapes before or since that have been so cut. I hope you enjoy the rest of the talk.
had Dale here, you'd be checked.
Yes, yeah. Because the heroes and heroines represent those who are overcoming and that are becoming initiated into the mysteries. And we'll talk a lot about that because there is the whole notion of seven rays. And each of the seven rays has a planetary ruler. And obviously, Odysseus and people like Sisyphus represent the mercurial ray type of hero. And the story varies with each of them. If you look at, like, if you take a martial type of hero like Heracles or Sir Launcelot or somebody like that, they have very parallel lives in their mythical drama as opposed to the parallel lives of the mercurial types of heroes. So we could get on that, and we will get to that eventually. The thing that is really, it's not just the Greeks, but in our period, the thing that is the great work for us in the post-Atlantean civilization, after the clouds of Atlantis have cleared up and we can see clearly into the external world and not so much into the internal world, one of the goals of our evolution at this time is to be very keen and very alert and very perceptive about what is going on in the external world. And the divinities, who not only embody the myths, but they're direct the way that they're told, make sure that there are, in our times, a lot of myths where there are clever, cunning heroes, because this is what, you know, what I'm trying to say is what we do every day. I go to work every day, and I work with computers, which I'm not in the least interested in, and I have fun with them anyway. But there are people that are learning very special kinds of consciousness that are working on an assembly line where they do just one thing, and they have to trust that everybody else is doing their own one thing just right. And that develops a really special kind of consciousness that was never before there was mass production. And in the same way, in our times, it is extremely important that we develop a practical, material mind. As earthy as it may be, it's an important thing to do, because the objectivity and the ability to utilize our mind for very practical matters right now is the key for the development of the mind for later stages of evolution. And it's like sunlight on a plant. If you deprive a plant of sunlight of a given type, it will, all of its future generations will be not proper. You know, they'll be runted, or they'll be distorted or something like that. And our whole future evolution is like that with regard to many things. And so if we don't develop this Sisyphal kind of mind of being very practical and thinking on our feet and being able to do things in the material world, we're failing. If we're too otherworldly, in short, we are not doing what we should do. So Sisyphus represents then some sort of vanguard of development for humanity. Now he sees Zeus abduct, what is her name? Aegina, from the Aegean Sea, was named after a while, and sees the two of them come together. These are symbolic. There's an awful lot of copulation in Greek myths. And the Greeks were not sexually prepossessed. The Greeks were involved with sexuality, or seeing sexuality as a creative activity. I think from here we might go to creation myths next time. And we're going to look, you know, this is previews. This is going to be all previews of coming attractions always. And so what Sisyphus is seeing is he when to see Zeus in any form is to be seeing something in the spiritual worlds. And it's no different when Carlos Castaneda can understand the eagle, or when Sisyphus sees the eagle bearing off Aegina. And so what we're talking about there, this is a spiritual state. And it's one of those things, our words as they are right now are very mundane words. And to talk about personal, to talk about spiritual experiences personally is to defile them. And to say, well, I had this vision or I saw this in the spiritual world is a kind of profanation. And so this is what happens with Sisyphus. He saw part of the divine creative activity and he blabbed about it. But to have even seen that means he was beloved of Zeus in the first place. Otherwise he wouldn't have, he wouldn't have been given that. Clearly, as we're going to see when we talk about the mystery myths, which I thought I was going to talk about tonight, the going into the underworld, into the realm of the dead, as Paul says, I die daily, meaning he leaves his body every day, whether it is the story of Christ in the vehicle of Jesus doing this consciously and living this out before people, or whether it is Sisyphus going into the underworld and then coming back and living, this is talking about a state of consciousness where one redeems what is lost in so-called hell and sees the spiritual realities. So we're saying that he not only had a divine vision of Zeus as the eagle in heaven, but he also had a vision of the underworld and all of the things of death in the underworld. So we're at the point of punishment. It isn't punishment. Even the archaeologists agree that the rock was probably the sun, and that pushing the sun up the hill, it's talking about instead of having a small scale level of consciousness where we live day by day, the consciousness of Sisyphus was geared to looking at the entire year in the same way that the sun rises up to its noon position and then sinks back down to the earth again and is invisible. The same thing happens with the declination of the sun. It rises up into the northern latitudes and then sinks back down again. This is a theme that we're going to look at many, many different ways, but the point I just want to make is a very simple point about Sisyphus. When he's pushing the stone up the hill, it's the very same thing that the initiates in the temple of Odin used to do. There used to be a cart with goats on it, and this was Odin's cart, and it had the disc of the sun on it. And the part of the initiatory ceremony was to pull the cart with the sun on it that had the goats in part of it. This not only means just identifying with the work of the sun in the large annual sense, this is to be taken literally. That is to say, one does not just come into the spiritual world and be treated to a banquet of spiritual wisdom and then come back and live the way that you lived before. There is a great responsibility. Unto whom much is given, much is expected. And truly, as we grow in wisdom, we no longer live a personal life. When we become heroes, we live a divine life. And part of that life is the work of not only guiding our every day-to-day personal existence, but we guide the earth itself. That is to say, there is this great evolutionary path, very complex, very wound in a multidimensional spiral, and to move the sun, which means to move the earth, we're literally in the process of floating the earth with our own soul bodies as we become more soulful and enlightened. And to guide the sun means literally to be homed in on the path of wisdom and to be living a greater life. And by doing that, we literally guide the sun in its path. That becomes our work. And so the Sisyphal task, which it looks like a horrible, grueling type of thing, is really a divine honor. And so even though quite a few myths can be taken literally, some of them are inverted or at least partially inverted. Some of the Sisyphus myth is inverted and some of it isn't. So we're ready to look at another story.
So what you're saying is that his punishment that is kind of like a burden is
really a blessing.
Is the work and responsibility of the spiritual aspect.
Yes, yes. In fact, it's the work for all humanity. When all humanity becomes enlightened in as one, we will be the composite earth spirit. And we will literally float the earth and together as a conscious meditation, all working together as a one, we will literally guide that earth and everything on it that is evolving, that is in a creature state, to see that it gets the proper conditions. That is our work. Okay, so it's time to look at another myth. And that is also in hell, and it's another one that's also semi-inverted. Ixion is usually pictured right next to Sisyphus. Ixion is usually pictured right next to Sisyphus in hell, or in Tartarus. I like Tartarus better. Hell is actually from the Norse mythology. Ixion has several meanings in translation. One potential meaning is strong moon man. The other is mistletoe. And the mistletoe is probably the more likely meaning because people in those days, because they were not yet fully awakened in potential in the material world, very often had to use physical substances or physical methods such as breathing exercises. In those days, things like herbs or breathing methods were necessary to leave the body, and mistletoe was one of them. It forms the whole basis of a wonderful mythological study by Sir James Frazer, which is many volumes long. It's called The Golden Bough, talking about the mistletoe being what the initiate who crossed the river into the underworld had to carry with him. He had to carry the bough of mistletoe. And mistletoe, there'll be some more on mistletoe later on as we talk about the myth. Ixion is the son of Phlegis, meaning fiery, from last time we talked about the children of fire. It makes a lot of sense. And he was married to Dia, D-I-A, who was the goddess of the oak cult. And the oak cult was, you know, the mistletoe that grew on oaks was sacred to the mysteries of Jupiter, whereas if it grew on something like birches, it was then sacred to Heracles or the martial ray. Ixion and Dia marry, and they have a son named Perithous. However, it was a rather unusual kind of marriage. And this is a myth that I don't understand, and I'm sure it's got an inversion in it somewhere, because no reason is even given for it. There are a lot of archaeological explanations for it, but I don't want to get into that. He invites his father-in-law to the wedding banquet before the wedding and says, I'm going to have great presents for you, and it's going to be a wondrous feast, and it's going to go on forever and ever, this wonderful wedding feast. But what he has done is outside of the gates of his palace, he has dug a huge pitfall. And in that huge pitfall, he has prepared a charcoal fire. And he covers it over so it doesn't look like it's even there. And his father-in-law comes for the wedding ceremony with his whole entourage, and they all get there, and they get burned up. Not a good way to get on good footing with the in-laws. That was not intended. I wouldn't put it past my fiendish subconscious to think that way. Everybody abhors him. He gets both kingdoms, his own and his father-in-law's. But everybody abhors him. He's hated of all men, and he's even hated of the gods. But he's a pretty bold chap, and he goes to Zeus, and he pleads for mercy. And Zeus gives him mercy and figures, you know, I've had a few indiscretions myself, and therefore I should be big and I should be forgiving. And he's not only merciful toward Tantalus, but he likes him because he does things in a grand style. And so he takes him up into Olympus, and he actually feeds him right at his own table. And Ixion, though, is a man of great desire. And as he's there, he sees Hera, and she's beautiful. And he desires her. But as wise as he is, he doesn't realize that the laws in heaven are different than the laws on earth. Because when you're in the inner worlds, unless you can lie on a deeper plane in the spiritual worlds, it's kind of hard to lie, because everybody can read the manifestations of your thoughts. You know, they come out. If they come out as, you know, fiendish bats or something like that, or suddenly start emanating from your aura, somebody says, this person has no good in mind. Or somebody starts spewing flowers out from within, they say, ah, this is very lovely. And Zeus reads his thoughts, and he sees that he desires Hera, and he takes a cloud out of the stuff of the heaven worlds, and he makes a surrogate or a false Hera out of the cloud. And Ixion is so drunk from the divine nectar that his desire gets away on him, and he takes the cloud. And the cloud, by the way, has the name cloud, Nephali. In fact, out of this union, something was actually even born. The centaurs, which are called the Magnesian mares, because one of the kingdoms that was ruled by Ixion was Magnesia. Horse milk was not called milk of Magnesia. But he too was scourged by Hermes, and he was lashed and lashed and lashed until he was to cry out and cry it out fully that benefactors deserve honor. You can see this is a more Zeusian or Jupiterian type of tale than it is a mercurial tale. And his punishment is that he is carried down into the underworld and he's crucified. But he's crucified on a disc, a fiery disc, and he's crucified in the X fashion. And in fact, he's bound to the wheel in four places, on his ankles, on his wrists, and on his neck. And he continuously rolls around heaven on this fiery disc for eternity, and that's his punishment. The only time that anybody ever gets any respite is when Orpheus, who we're going to talk about eventually, when Orpheus gets down into the underworld and plays his music, and it completely spellbinds things so that Sisyphus doesn't have to push his stone and the wheel stops rolling for a while. Exactly right on this. Looks like it's going to be just about 90 minutes right on the head. And that's Orpheus enchants them, and that's the only time that they ever get any rest. Okay, so we have another story here that is a semi-inversion. I'm not so sure about the slaying part, and I'll tell you outright, I'm just not going to talk about symbols that I don't know the meaning of. And if I speculate, I'll give you the fact that they're speculating, that they're speculations. We talked a little bit about mistletoe and oaks, and their mistletoe is very strongly tied up with the moon, because the moon is the lady of the desire body, the astral body. And supposedly the mistletoe is the first plant that has an astral body. And there are scientific studies that have been done and shown that when you have an astral body, you're subject to astral influences, which means not only animal qualities, but starry qualities. And there are studies, the anthroposophists have done big studies on how the nature of mistletoe, how it varies at different positions of the moon. You're familiar with the work, Agnes Pfeiff's Moon and Plant? It's a pretty renowned study, at least in Europe, for proving that there are relationships between heavenly bodies and plants other than things like heliotropism and lunar tropism and things like that. But mistletoe then was a plant that had some kind of narcotic type of effect and had something to do with that. Again, we have the whole quality of cunning and treachery coming up, and we have the quality of forgiveness. Because clearly, everyone who has gone through the mysteries, be they the Eleusinian mysteries or the mysteries of Isis and Osiris or the ancient Indian mysteries, all of them, their lives were changed. And no matter what they were before they entered the mysteries, when they had been initiated and had gone into the realm of the dead and came back, they became exemplary people. Even people who were only on the outer edges of the mysteries, the neophyte epopte in the Eleusinian mysteries, even their lives were improved. And all of them, to a person, said that they were blessed and that they were blessed by mercy. And one of the really good things about the mysteries is the attitude of gratitude, and that they took this as a blessing for having been forgiven for their very human ways. Clearly, the feasting in heaven is again another way of talking about partaking of divine characteristics, of being able to take part in creativity, of living a divine life. We're going to find out when we talk about the mystery schools and the mystery with myths in particular that one lived through them. One literally acted them out, and it wasn't just an intellectual process. Obviously, what got him to there, whether you call him Strong Moon Man or whether you call him Mistletoe, the characteristic that got him to where he got was the imagination. The fact that he could, you know, there are two types of thinking. The type of thinking that's in vogue right now among scientists and materialists is a kind of thinking that is invisible thinking. It's abstract. It's an empty. I make this connection with this and that connection with that. And that's only partial thinking. Wholesome spiritual thinking, which is full thinking, produces images. And Ixion was obviously capable of producing images. However, in his desire, he probably carried it too far. And in all mystery schools of all times, in fact, among priests in the Catholic Church, it was the secret, unforgivable sin to make love to an etheric entity. And, or when you take the story of Saint Benedict, Saint Benedict figured he'd go to a place where there would be no temptation. He dug a pit down on the ground, and he tried to live down in that pit. And that way he could avoid all of the more earthly temptations. And then the etheric entities started appearing to him while he was down in the pit and trying to lure him into all sorts of lurid behavior. What I'm trying to say is that a good part of developing clairvoyance, the ability to see into the inner worlds, is imaginatory work. But we have to be careful in our imaginatory work that we don't carry it too far and produce entities and, in fact, fall in love with our own productions, as in the case of the false Hera, mock Hera. And this is probably what has happened to him. And he was brought to realize gratitude by the scourging. But again, this is a partly direct myth, because part of it is really, he did err in his lusting and desiring and materializing his imaginations too far and then falling in love with his own creations. But it's also partly an inversion, because the description of him being crucified on a wheel of fire is literal of what occurred in the mysteries of Isis and Osiris in Egypt. The initiate was crucified, spread eagle, and he was crucified in the same places, and there were lights on the wheel, and there were fires before the wheel. And again, we have the same myth, you know, this, the literally the punishment of Ixion is identical with the punishment of Sisyphus, and neither is a punishment fully. Both of them have become sun people. That is, they are creators of light, and they have this wheel of fire. That is what they've become. All right, so we've looked at two mixed myths. See, where the whole idea is, even though we're telling a lot of little side stories on the side and looking at things on the side, but the whole idea is we have to look at a myth to see that there is the possibility of inversion. So now let's look at one where there is no inversion or very little inversion. The first two are mixed mode. And let's look at one more myth, and this one also comes from the underworld. This is the myth of Tantalus. It's a pretty straightforward myth. Again, we have to talk about the lineages, because the lineages are really important. I don't know if we'll get a chance to go into them. Maybe if we do some scriptural mythology, which is something I had intended to do, but it's going to be an awfully short year, and I don't know if I want to string this one on for several years, though I might, because it's really fun stuff. But in the lineages of who begets who and such, that's literally, you can take those things almost like the resolution of chords in music. Because this is answered with this, and this is answered with this, and there is a progression of consciousness. And the names represent states of consciousness, and what begets what becomes a very important thing. So let's look at Tantalus. Kronos and Rhea, or ocean, Oceanus and Tethys. It's not really true. It's not really clear which pair were which. Had a daughter named Pluto, meaning wealthy. This is not Hades as Pluto, but this is not Hades as Pluto, because Pluto is a synonym also for Hades. There is also Pluto as wealthy. In fact, that's even Plato Socrates tries to tie the two together. And Pluto was married to or had an affair with Zeus. And the offspring of that is Tantalus. Tantalus means lurching or most wretched. However, there's another meaning, another source of lineage. Oh boy, another oak king. I'm not even going to try. You can pronounce that one. He was an oak king, and he was married to the famous queen. I forget what her deeds were in heaven. I have to look up. He was married to Omphale. Which one of the meanings of Omphale is mammary gland. In fact, Omphale used to be markers on the earth of sacred places of the earth. They used to take stones and put other stones on top, and they were called Omphale. Probably because they were spots where the oak mysteries were celebrated. And Tmolus and Omphale are a potential source also of Tantalus. We might end up knowing some Greek and some Egyptian and some Latin and quite a few other languages by the time we're done. He married Uranasi, and he had a number of children, Pelops, Brotius, and his daughter, who was the most famous, Niobe. That's a really good, if you take the other lineage, if you take Pluto, let's take Pluto, and Zeus, and then Tantalus lurching, and then Niobe. That's a real resolution of consciousness. This is wealth and magnification in brightness produce Tantalus, the lurching one. And out of Tantalus comes, you know, like this, out of all of this, the lurch is the lurch of desire, clearly. And out of this is born a huge pride. Remember Niobe? She had seven sons and seven daughters. And she said that they were more beautiful than the children of heaven, than the children of Apollo and Artemis. And she was so puffed up and proud that she lost them all. I think Apollo slew them all with his arrows, and they all died right before her, and there she her fate was to lose, to have her pride punctured for claiming to be better than the gods with her beautiful children. It's the famous poem by Moore that said he was making fun of Richard Blackmore, who was a famed physician, and who, as a famed physician, Moore didn't like doctors. He thought that they were all quacks. And he had the poem, "'Twas from his carriage the sublime." He also wrote bad poetry. "'Twas from his carriage the sublime Sir Richard Blackmore used to rhyme. Like Phoebus in his car at ease, now warbling forth a lofty song, now murdering young Niobes." That's from if you ever read Bullfinch's mythology, it's a lovely mythology. He brings in lovely little cultural spatterings in there. Okay. Tantalus was sort of a Venusian type of person, filled with lustful desire. He was sort of indiscriminate, as you can get that way. If you get to the negative side of Venus, you go for pretty tacky things. And he seduced both males and females. Ganymede was one of his people. But the way he did it was, he was quite a beautiful man, and he also was allowed to be in heaven and eat nectar and drink, eat ambrosia and drink nectar, only he would sneak it down to earth, and he would use it for seducing people, male and female, to fulfill his desires. And his desires were huge. But he not only took nectar and ambrosia from heaven and cast pearls before swine, but he also blabbed about divine spirits. But this wasn't his worst thing. He invited the gods down to heaven. But he was a cheapskate. Yeah, down from heaven, down to earth. And he was a cheapskate, and he didn't have enough for a sumptuous meal. So what he did is he cut up his son and threw his son, Pelops, into the stew. Again, he was filled with the earthly illusion that you can get away with things and you can have sneaky thoughts and nobody will ever find you out. And he served this meal to the gods come down to earth, and none of them would eat any of it except Demeter, who was distracted by the loss of her daughter Persephone, and she took one bite out of the shoulder. The gods were so abhorrent of this that they not only brought the son back to life but gave him an ivory shoulder, but immediately took him into Tartarus. And in Tartarus he was given a whole bunch of punishments. He was made to stand in a lake with water up to here, and it was a marshy lake, and he was given eternal thirst. And every time he would bend down, the water would recede. And every time he would try to scoop water out, it would get away through his fingers. Not only that, he was given eternal hunger because he had abused the nectar and ambrosia. And overhead there were trees with all sorts of fruits. And every time he would reach for them, they would sway away. So here he has perpetual hunger and perpetual thirst. And anyway, that wasn't enough. There was a huge stone that was perched right over his head that was on the verge of falling and crushing him. And so he was given a perpetual vulnerability, that is, so that he would, even in eternity, he was always had a rock hanging over his head. The latter punishment was for a special punishment, because he not only did all of those things, but he also, when he was allowed into the underworld, he stole the golden mastiff. That was the dog that guarded, like the three-headed dog Cerberus. There was the golden mastiff in earlier times that guarded the underworld, and he stole that. And he hid it and said somebody else had it. Okay, so we've looked at that story. Now this story is not an inversion. That's why I included this myth in. This one is a literal, straight-out one. There's no inversion here. Nectar and ambrosia are clearly states of consciousness. Higher, it's to this day yet in India, when they talk about nectar, they're talking about the passing of a state of consciousness, something that's passed from one person to another. But to take this and use it for personal pleasure and personal glorification is horrid. It is to take the truth of spiritual things, the beauty of spiritual things, the living vitality of spiritual things, and to devaluate them into something material. Very, very gross. But the other extremely gross thing that he did, he not only took spiritual things and brought them into material values, but he took material things and tried to make them divine. That's what feeding his children to the gods is. He's literally taking his material progeny and trying to have them be consumed as they are by the divine, as though he were giving the gods a treat. So it is, in both cases, he tried to make something divine material, and he tried to make something profane and material divine. And he couldn't get away with either of them. And the out-and-out theft, clearly, Tantalus is a man of great desire. And the punishments are not inverted punishments, as in the case of Sisyphus and Ixion. They're literal. Because Tartarus is in the desire world. And the chief law of the desire world, which also functions in the material world, but if you're completely in the desire world, we're talking about a purgatory now, where you're throwing off all of your, the physical body rots when you die, but so does the desire body rot when you die. But it's made up of all of your desires, your emotions, your feelings, and as it rots, you refuel them. And you refuel them with the reality of the way it works in the desire world. And the chief law in the desire world is the law of attraction and repulsion. If you love, if you give, you attract things to you. If you take something selfishly to yourself, you repulse people from you. Clearly, Tantalus is a person of great desire, and it's all selfish desire. And the desire itself, because if the desire isn't divinely motivated, if it's selfishly motivated, the effect of it is going to be repulsive. And everything about the nature of Tantalus and all of his punishment is very clearly desire. Now, there is a creature, every time, we have bat-like thoughts, we produce little bats. They're not really the physical bats. But they all coalesce together into producing one creature that guards the door to the underworld. and that creature is called the guardian of the threshold, which was symbolized by the dog, the Hermanubis. And a mastiff is right, because the Egyptians, the Egyptian Hermes, pictured the dog as a Rottweiler, which is a close relative of the mastiff. And it was probably a Tibetan mastiff was the original. In fact, to this day, the Buddhist temples are guarded by Tibetan mastiffs. I have a friend that has a Tibetan mastiff in town. He's a beautiful dog. I'll show him to you sometime. So the stealing of that means he was really possessed by it. The rock hanging over his head, he had he didn't use his thought merely to learn things. He used his thought and congealed his thought and desire together, which is what the heavy hanging rock is over his head. All right, we're getting a little long, and I want to be done in 90 minutes. So that's the story. So we've looked at two mixed myths now, where part of the myth is to be taken literally, and part of the myth is to be taken invertedly. Now we've looked at one where it is all to be taken literally. It's all true. Now we have one last story where we'll look at where everything in the story is completely inverted. Only this one doesn't take place in Tartarus. Is this too many stories in one night? Okay, because these are little ones. We could do a lot with all of them. And this is of a totally different order of myth, and it doesn't take place in Tartarus at all, but it's a complete inversion. It's a story of the blue nymph Lyrope, who marries Cephissus, a river god. And out of them is born a beautiful, beautiful child named Narcissus. Narcissus means benumbing, as in stunning. Or it means narcosis. Our word narcotic comes directly from the word Narcissus. When he was born, his mother was uncertain, as everybody who does anything with astrology knows that new mothers are uncertain about the fate of their child, and the first thing they do is head for the astrologer to find out what the fate of their child is going to be. And she went to, not the astrologer, but to a seer who himself was an initiate. His name was Tiresias. We'll talk about why you can know he was an initiate at another time. And Tiresias said something very curious about him. She was concerned about his ultimate welfare. And Tiresias said, Narcissus will live to a ripe old age, provided he never knows himself. Curious. But as a baby, he was a beautiful baby. As a child, he was a beautiful child. And as a youth, he was a beautiful youth. Everybody fell in love with him. Gods, nymphs, humans of both sexes. And he was completely disinterested in all of them. He just sort of, in a dazed way, floated through life. In fact, one of the famous encounters comes from, it's first really written down by Ovid, the poet. Ovid wrote, the Metamorphoses is a wonderful thing to read, and there are some good translations of it, and it's all kinds of love poetry and the retelling of the myths. And he tells the story about Echo. And Echo was another nymph, and she had the ability to use words and be extremely persuasive with them. She could tell stories, she could recite poetry, she could do all of those things, but she misused it. Zeus, who had power over her, had her tell stories to Hera while he was out messing around. He was keeping her preoccupied with stories. And Hera found out about it and condemned her in her glory, took away all of her ability to use words, and the only time she could use words is if she was repeating something that somebody else had at last said. And so she can't talk, and so she hides herself in the forest, and one day Narcissus is out looking for him, out hunting, and she sees him, and she's drawn to him, and he's out all alone, he's lost in the woods. And he says, is anybody here? And she says, here. And he says, come. And she says, come.
What's her name again?
Echo.
Oh, this is Echo, okay.
Yeah. And he says, why do you avoid me? And she says, why do you avoid me? And he says, let us come together. And she says, let us come together. And he comes to her, she comes to him out of the woods and embraces him, and he pushes her off really firmly. He said, I would die with you before you would lie with me. And she said, lie with me. And he just trudges off. And she asks that he be punished. And a little further on in his life, a young man, Amenius, falls in love with him and pleads his suit to him and keeps pestering him. And Narcissus will have no part of it, and he sends him his sword as a present. And Arminius takes it and commits suicide, and the gods can't stand suicide. And so they decide to punish Narcissus, and Narcissus goes off in the woods and he finds this pool. And it's a sheltered pool that no leaves even fall in. And he looks in the pool and he sees his image. And as he sees his image, he is astounded at how beautiful it is. And he tries to kiss it first, and he can't kiss it. And no matter what, he can't unite with this image. And he becomes so frustrated by it that he takes his sword and he kills himself. And his last words are, alas. And Echo in the wood says, alas. And Echo goes on to wither away until only her voice is left. And where Narcissus is where the white out of his blood springs the red and white narcissi. And that's the story of Narcissus. This story is a complete inversion. It seems a horrible story. It seems a very, very difficult story. He has that beauty that can only come about when you develop the male and female in yourself. He has that divine androgynous beauty. And it's a beauty that carries all the way, so that it is, with it, is a chastity. It comes right along with it. This is a myth of sex and death. It is capable of being interpreted literally. You can take this myth and say that this is the way psychologists take it. You can withdraw into your own self and become so self-absorbed that you think about nothing else. And there is a character type that is called a narcissistic type. And that's true, but that isn't the way the myth is meant. If you look at the words that Theseus uses, Tiresias uses, it is Narcissus will live to a ripe old age provided he never knows himself. Not sees himself, but knows himself. The Greeks, like all of the mystery schools, had the inner worlds partitioned. Not that they did it, that's the way they registered things. And they had what was called the ladder of the stars, that from the earth, each layer that emanated from the earth out was a planetary sphere. And those spheres were related to the speed of the planet as it moved, so that the closest sphere was called the moon sphere, and the next one was the Mercury sphere, the next one the Venus, the next one the Sun. Oh, two Venuses. The next one, Mars. The next one, Jupiter. And then the gatekeeper was Saturn. And then there were three levels outside of this. This literally is a myth that comes, that you find in various forms in all different cultures. This was called the ladder of the stars. And at certain times of the years, having to do with solstices and equinoxes, it was possible to climb the ladder of the stars, and when you reached the outside, then you reached the Milky Way. But there were three layers. They're sometimes pictured as skins, but they're actually much larger than all of the other emanatory layers, and they were called the firmament. And outside of the firmament was the crystallium, and then outside of that was the primum mobile.
At what level was this?
That's outside of the realm of Saturn. The firmament was where the stars were set in, or where there were openings out into the crystallium, and beyond that was the primum mobum, the prime mover. The crystallium is what we're interested in, because the crystallium is, this is common in all mythologies, or it's common in all spiritual teachings, that after you get past the phenomenal realms, the realms of energy, activity, the etheric realms, the realms of desire and feeling, and the realms of concrete thinking, there is another lens. And that from there is the lens to the true spiritual worlds. And those true spiritual worlds, the world that is associated with human spirit, or ideation, was associated with Neptune and the firmament. But beyond that was a realm where one got beyond even the idea of self. And that is a realm that is a realm of pure light, of pure love, of pure creativity, and that is described as the crystallium. It is like when you get an intuition, everything seems very bright and everything seems very clear. Like, you know, like in the cartoons, the light goes on over somebody's head. But it's a different kind of light. It's not like these lights. It's like a light of knowing. Only our little lights of knowing are as nothing before the experience of the crystallium, which crystallium means crystal. The realm of crystal light. This is known in Western lore as the realm of life spirit. or the consciousness of Christ. The experience of Narcissus in seeing himself, in knowing himself, means he even transcended selfhood into the realm of pure light, of pure knowledge. The only way you can know yourself and get beyond the problem of self, you know, like a lot of people try to destroy ego or try to destroy self, but by transcending that to pure love, to pure light, which is associated with an androgyne type of character, because the essence of that love is like the love that is altruism. And so the experience of Narcissus is the experience of seeing into the life spirit, into seeing into that love and light that is so dense it's like a crystal, and is as perfectly organized as that. And that's where the complete inversion comes in. The suicide in all spiritual lore, does not mean killing the physical body. It's like Goethe did a really excellent exposition of that about these two brothers. The younger Werther is the poem that it's in. And he talks about the two brothers having such promise, and the younger one decides on the spiritual life and he commits suicide. It affected so many people that there was a rash of romantic young men that in fact did commit suicide. But in order to reach the crystallium, you can no longer live for yourself. You commit a personal suicide. You can no longer think, well, this is fair for me. You have to give yourself over to that pure light, to that pure love, or in the Christian parlance, what we only hear in curse words these days, you have to live for the Christ's sake. When you do that, then you have committed suicide to personal experience. And then can you, you know, even though it seems Narcissus dies, he really lives. And it's all tied up. This is a complete inversion, that the sending of the sword to the man who loved him, who killed him, he was killing himself by the sexual energy in desiring. Because the sexual energy, as it rises up the spine, has always been a symbol of has always been symbolized by the sword. And the suicide, that the flower grows out of the sword, literally, I had a picture and I tried to find it. It's an artistic representation of somebody who sees somebody in a meditative state, and with what he sees with his clairvoyant eyes, it's like serpents of fire and spinning wheels coming up, and it's like a sword rising of flame, lovely flame, and then here, from here out, it produces a huge, big flower. The voice box being at the heart of the flower. We may talk about the Grail later on, the English version, and we'll talk about the Grail cup later on. But what we're talking about is the flower coming out of the death by the sword, and the blood not just being physical blood, but being the life blood of the life essence that goes through the spine, or the kundalini, as you call it. So here we have a case where it seems like a horrible thing. This beautiful young man who doesn't cling to the earth at all dies and turns into a flower, and it commits suicide, in fact, when he could have had anything or anyone that he wanted in the entire world. And the truth of it is just the inverse of that. It's a very, very beautiful thing. This isn't a simpleton that is admiring his own beauty. He's trying to kiss something that is beyond it in the pool. You know, the intuition has always been symbolized in mythology by the kiss. Because we only get little kisses of it. We can't truly embrace that life spirit yet, so we get a little kiss. So this is an example of a completely inverted myth. So we're left with a dilemma. It's not simple such that we can take every myth literally. Some are inverted at different levels. How do we know when to take them straight forward? How do we know when to look at them invertedly? Tantalus, we said we had to take straight forward. This one we have to say we have to take invertedly. The only way we can do it is the way that Narcissus does it, is by intuition. The only way that we can really tell the truth of something of a mythical nature is if we intuit the truth of it. So we have to give ourselves, we have to point our swords toward the meaning of the myth and let them speak themselves out to us. And so what I'm trying to do totally in these talks is trying to give you intuitive looks as they seem to be intuitive to me. Afterwards, you can test them by your mind, and you can predict, and you can see what the offspring of them are, whether they're Niobes or whether they're something that has an inner meaning that is very fruitful to your own spiritual development. And I think they must be tested, because if the mind is not put to them, that's like receiving the nectar and not doing anything with it. And all right, so now we have a little bit more of an idea of the feeling of the way myths work, both directly and inversely. And next time we'll go on talking about we'll take a school of myths that treat a different idea and work with that. Who's that?
Echo.
I think that's a divertimento. I think it's a divertimento, and I don't think it has a special meaning except to show the emptiness of purely material phenomena as juxtaposed to the... If you have the cow, you don't have to worry about where you're going to buy milk. And if you have something inside of yourself of spiritual nature, you're not going to be allured as Tantalus was allured by the things of the earth and distracted away from the source of...
He wasn't interested in that call.
I don't know if that was intended in, because that's something that appears late in the myth of Narcissus. In the earlier renditions, it doesn't come in, and so I don't know that that's... It doesn't mean that the earlier renditions are more true. Sometimes it turns out that later renditions are better because people are ready for more of it, and the myths evolve, you know, the gods evolve through experiencing us, and as we grow, their unfoldment grows also.